Hello, this is Margaret Dixon at 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield, Massachusetts, on Page Turners. And today we will be reading a fun little messed up story called Sredni Vashtar by Saki. It's a delightful little tale of a little boy's imagination gone too far, or possibly something supernatural. I'll let you decide on your own. Conradin was 10 years old, and the doctor had pronounced his professional opinion that the boy would not live another 5 years. The doctor was silky and effete and counted for little, but his opinion was endorsed by Mrs. de Ropp, who counted for nearly everything. Mrs. de Ropp was Conradin's cousin and guardian, and in his eyes she represented those 3/5 of the world that are necessary and disagreeable and real. The other 2/5, in perpetual antagonism to the foregoing, were summed up in himself and his imagination. One of these days, Conradin supposed he would succumb to the mastering pressure of wearisome, necessary things, such as illnesses and coddling restrictions and drawn-out dullness. Without his imagination, which was rampant under the spur of loneliness, he would have succumbed long ago. Mrs. de Ropp would never, in her honestest moments, have confessed to herself that she disliked Conradin, though she might have been dimly aware that thwarting him for his good was a duty which she did not find particularly irksome. Conradin hated her with a desperate sincerity which he was perfectly able to mask. Such few pleasures as he could contrive for himself gained an added relish from the likelihood that they would be displeasing to his guardian, and from the realm of his imagination she was locked out, an unclean thing which should find no entrance. In the dull, cheerless garden, overlooked by so many windows that were ready to open with a message not to do this or that, or a reminder that medicines were due, he found little attraction. The few fruit trees that it contained were set jealously apart from his plucking, as though they were rare specimens of their kind blooming in an arid waste. It would probably have been difficult to find a market gardener who would have offered 10 shillings for their entire yearly produce. In a forgotten corner, however, almost hidden behind a dismal shrubbery, was a disused tool shed of respectable proportions, and within its walls, Conradin found a haven, something that took on the varying aspects of a playroom and a cathedral. He had peopled it with a legion of familiar phantoms, evoked partly from fragments of history and partly from his own brain. But it also boasted 2 inmates of flesh and blood. In one corner lived a ragged, plumaged Hoden hen, on which the boy lavished an affection that had scarcely another outlet. Further back in the gloom stood a large hutch, divided into 2 compartments, one of which was fronted with close iron bars. This was the abode of a large polecat ferret, which a friendly butcher boy had once smuggled, cage and all, into its present quarters in exchange for a long-secreted hoard of small silver. Conradin was dreadfully afraid of the lithe, sharp-faned beast, but it was his most treasured possession. Its very presence in the tool shed was a secret and fearful joy to be kept scrupulously from the knowledge of the woman, as he privately dubbed his cousin. And one day, out of heaven knows what material, he spun the beast a wonderful name, and from that moment it grew into a god in religion. The woman indulged in religion once a week at a church nearby and took Conradin with her, but to him the church service was an alien rite in the house of Rimmon. Every Thursday, in the dim and musty silence of the tool shed, he worshipped with mystic and elaborate ceremonial before the wooden hutch where dwelt Sredni Vashtar, the great ferret. Red flowers in their season and scarlet berries in the wintertime were offered at his shrine, for he was a god who laid some special stress on the fierce, impatient side of things, as opposed to the woman's religion, which, as far as Conradin could observe, went to great lengths in the contrary direction. and on great festivals, powdered nutmeg was strewn in front of his hutch, an important feature of the offering being that the nutmeg had to be stolen. These festivals were of irregular occurrence and were chiefly appointed to celebrate some passing event. On one occasion, when Mrs. de Ropp suffered from acute toothache for 3 days, Conradin kept up the festival during the entire 3 days and almost succeeded in persuading himself that Sredni Vashtar was personally responsible for the toothache. If the malady had lasted for another day, the supply of nutmeg would have given out. Getting a bit odd, but I'm sure we've all had our phases as a child of worshipping a ferret. And we'll see where this leads after a message from our sponsor.
Whoa, like, what exactly is happening here?
89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield.
Support for WTBR comes from MyCom Federal Credit Union, 101 Fenn Street in Pittsfield, where their mission is to continue to promote the principle of people helping people while providing services that meet the diverse and ever-changing needs of their membership. MyCom Federal Credit Union, online at mycomcu.org. And, do you need help heating your home? Berkshire Community Action Council may be able to help. The Fuel Assistance Program is accepting new applications beginning November 1st. This program assists with your primary heating source, including all heating types. Once you're eligible for fuel assistance, you're also eligible for a discount on your electric bill. Go to bcacinc.org for more information.
For those just tuning in, this is Margaret Dixon with Page Turners, reading Sredni Vashtar by Saki. The Hoden hen was never drawn into the cult of Sredni Vashtar. Conradin had long ago settled that she was an Anabaptist. He did not pretend to have the remotest knowledge as to what an Anabaptist was, but he privately hoped that it was dashing and not very respectable. Mrs. de Ropp was the ground plan on which he based and detested all respectability. After a while, Conradin's absorption in the toolshed began to attract the notice of his guardian. "It is not good for him to be pottering down there in all weathers," she promptly decided. And at breakfast one morning, she announced that the Hoden hen had been sold and taken away overnight. With her short-sighted eyes, she peered at Conradin, waiting for an outbreak of rage and sorrow, which she was ready to rebuke with a flow of excellent precepts and reasoning. But Conradin said nothing. There was nothing to be said. Something perhaps in his white, set face gave her a momentary qualm, for at tea that afternoon there was toast on the table, a delicacy which he usually banned on the ground that it was bad for him, also because making of it gave trouble, a deadly offense in the middle-class feminine eye. "I thought you liked toast," she exclaimed with an injured air, observing that he did not touch it. "Sometimes," said Conradin. In the shed that evening, there was an innovation in the worship of the hutch god. Conradin had been wont to chant his praises. Tonight he asked a boon. "Do one thing for me, Sredni Vashtar." The thing was not specified. As Sredni Vashtar was a god, he must be supposed to know. And choking back a sob as he looked at that other empty corner, Conradin went back to the world he so hated. And every night, in the welcome darkness of his bedroom, and every evening in the dusk of the toolshed, Conradin's bitter litany went up. "Do one thing for me, Sredni Vashtar." Mrs. de Ropp noticed that the visits to the shed did not cease, and one day she made a further journey of inspection. "What are you keeping in that locked hutch?" she asked. "I believe it's guinea pigs. I'll have them all cleared away." Conradin shut his lips tight, but the woman ransacked his bedroom till she found the carefully hidden key, and forthwith marched down to the shed to complete her discovery. It was a cold afternoon, and Conradin had been bidden to keep to the house. From the furthest window of the dining room, the door of the shed could just be seen beyond the corner of the shrubbery, and there Conradin stationed himself. He saw the woman enter, and then he imagined her opening the door of the sacred hutch and peering down with her short-sighted eyes into the thick straw bed where his god lay hidden. Perhaps she would prod at the straw in her clumsy impatience. And Conradin fervently breathed his prayer for the last time. But he knew as he prayed that he did not believe. He knew that the woman would come out presently with that pursed smile he loathed so well on her face. And that in an hour or two, the gardener would carry away his wonderful god. A god no longer, but a simple brown ferret in a hutch. And he knew that the woman would triumph always as she triumphed now, and that he would grow ever more sickly under her pestering and domineering and superior wisdom, till one day nothing would matter much more with him, and the doctor would be proved right. And in the sting and misery of his defeat, he began to chant loudly and defiantly the hymn of his threatened idol. Sredni Vashtar went forth. His thoughts were red thoughts, and his teeth were white. His enemies called for peace, but he brought them death. Sredni Vashtar, the beautiful. And then of a sudden he stopped his chanting and drew closer to the window pane. The door of the shed still stood ajar as it had been left, and the minutes were slipping by. They were long minutes, but they slipped by nevertheless. He watched the starlings running and flying in little parties across the lawn. He counted them over and over again, with one eye always on that swinging door. A sour-faced maid came in to lay the table for tea, and still Conradin stood and waited and watched. Hope had crept by inches into his heart, and now a look of triumph began to blaze in his eyes that had only known the wistful patience of defeat. Under his breath, with a furtive exultation, he began once again the paean of victory and devastation. And presently his eyes were rewarded. Out through that doorway came a long, low, yellow and brown beast, with eyes ablink at the waning daylight, and dark, wet stains around the fur of jaws and throat. Conradin dropped on his knees. The great polecat ferret made its way down to a small brook at the foot of the garden, drank for a moment, then crossed a little plank bridge and was lost to sight in the bushes. Such was the passing of Sredni Vashtar. "Tea is ready," said the sour-faced maid. "Where is the mistress?" "She went down to the shed some time ago," said Conradin. And while the maid went to summon her mistress to tea, Conradin fished a toasting fork out of the sideboard drawer and proceeded to toast himself a piece of bread. And during the toasting of it, and the buttering of it with much butter, and the slow enjoyment of eating it, Conradin listened to the noises and silences which fell in quick spasms beyond the dining room door. The loud, foolish screaming of the maid, the answering chorus of wondering ejaculations from the kitchen region, the scuttering footsteps and hurried embassies for outside help, and then, after a lull, the scared sobbings and the shuffling tread of those who bore a heavy burden into the house. "Whoever will break it to the poor child? I couldn't for the life of me!" exclaimed a shrill voice. And while they debated the matter among themselves, Conradin made himself another piece of toast. Well, that certainly was cheerful. Well, for Conradin it was cheerful, at least. His abusive guardian, who had his pet killed, I suppose, got what she deserved. But was Sredni Vashtar really a god or not? I think it's left ambiguous, but, you know, it's up to you. For those just tuning in, this is Margaret Dixon with Page Turners. This next story is also by M.R. James. If you remember him from the last episode. And it's a little bit shorter, but it's just enough time, so let's dive right into it. It's called There Was a Man Dwelt by a Churchyard. This, you know, is the beginning of the story about sprites and goblins, which Mamilius, the best child in Shakespeare, was telling to his mother, the queen, and the court ladies, when the king came in with his guards and hurried her off to prison. There is no more of the story. Mamilius died soon after without having a chance of finishing it. Now, what was it going to have been? Shakespeare knew, no doubt, and I will be bold to say that I do. It was not going to be a news story. It was to be one which you have most likely heard and even told. Everybody may set it into what frame he likes best. This is mine. There was a man dwelt by a churchyard. His house had a lower story of stone and an upper one of timber. The front windows looked out on the street, and the back ones on the churchyard. It had once belonged to the parish priest, but, this was in Queen Elizabeth's days, the priest was a married man and wanted more room. Besides, his wife disliked seeing the churchyard at night, out of her bedroom window. She said she saw, but never mind what she said, anyhow. She gave her husband no peace till he agreed to move into a larger house in the village street, and the old one was taken by John Poole, who was a widower, and lived there alone. He was an elderly man who kept very much to himself, and people said he was something of a miser. It was very likely true. He was morbid in other ways, certainly. In those days, it was common to bury people at night and by torchlight, and was noticed that whenever a funeral was toward, John Poole was always at his window, either on the ground floor or upstairs, according as he could get the better view from one or the other. For those just tuning in, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners reading There Was a Man Dwelt by a Churchyard by M.R. James. There came a night when an old woman was to be buried. She was fairly well-to-do, but she was not liked in the place. The usual thing was said of her, that she was no Christian, and that on such nights as Midsummer Eve and All Hallows, she was not to be found in her house. She was red-eyed and dreadful to look at, and no beggar ever knocked at her door. Yet when she died, she left a purse of money to the church. There was no storm on the night of her burial. It was fair and calm. But there was some difficulty about getting bearers and men to carry the torches, in spite of the fact that she had left larger fees than common for such as did that work. She was buried in woolen, without a coffin. No one was there but those who were actually needed, and John Poole watching from his window. Just before the grave was filled in, the parson stooped down and cast something upon the body, something that clinked, and in a low voice he said words that sounded like, "Thy money perish with thee." Then he walked quickly away, and so did the other men, leaving only one torchbearer to light the sexton and his boy while they shoveled the earth in. They made no very neat job of it, and next day, which was a Sunday, the churchgoers were rather sharp with the sexton, saying it was the untidiest grave in the yard. And indeed, when he came to look at it himself, he thought it was worse than he had left it. Meanwhile, John Poole went about with a curious air, half exulting, as it were, and half nervous. More than once, he spent an evening at the inn, which was clean contrary to his usual habit, and to those who fell into talk with him there, he hinted that he had come into a little bit of money and was looking out for a somewhat better house. "Well, I don't wonder," said the smith one night. "I shouldn't care for that place of yours. I should be fancying things all night." The landlord asked him what sort of things. "Well, maybe somebody climbing up to the chamber window or the like of that," said the smith. "I don't know. Old Mother Wilkins that was buried a week ago today, eh?" "Come, I think you might consider of a person's feeling," said the landlord. "It ain't so pleasant for Master Poole, is it now?" "Master Poole don't mind," said the smith. "He's been there long enough to know. I only says it wouldn't be my choice. What with the passing bell and the torches when there's a burial, and all them graves lying so quiet when there's no one about. Only they say there's lights. Don't you never see no lights, Master Poole?" "No, I don't never see no lights," said Master Poole sulkily, and called for another drink and went home late. That night, as he lay in his bed upstairs, a moaning wind began to play about the house, and he could not go to sleep. He got up and crossed the room to a little cupboard in the wall. He took out of it something that clinked, and put it in the breast of his bedgown. Then he went to the window and looked out into the churchyard. Have you ever seen an old brass in a church with a figure of a person in a shroud? It is bunched together at the top of the head in a curious way. Something like that was sticking up out of the earth in a spot of the churchyard, which John Poole knew very well. He darted into his bed and lay there very still indeed. Presently, something made a very faint rattling at the casement. With a dreadful reluctance, John Poole turned his eyes that way. Alas! Between him and the moonlight was the black outline of the curious bunched head. Then there was a figure in the room. Dry earth rattled on the floor. A low, cracked voice said, "Where is it?" And steps went hither and thither, faltering steps as of one walking with difficulty. It could be seen now and again, peering into corners, stooping to look under chairs. Finally, it could be heard fumbling at the doors of the cupboard in the wall, throwing them open. There was a scratching of long nails on the empty shelves. The figure whipped around, stood for an instant at the side of the bed, raised its arms, and with a hoarse scream of, "You've got it!" At this point, HRH Prince Mamelius, who would, I think, have made the story a good deal shorter than this, flung himself with a loud yell upon the youngest of the court ladies present, who responded with an equally piercing cry. He was instantly seized upon by H.M. Queen Hermione, who, repressing an inclination to laugh, shook and slapped him very severely. Much flushed and rather inclined to cry, he was about to be sent to bed, but on the intercession of his victim, who had now recovered from the shock, he was eventually permitted to remain until his usual hour for retiring, by which he too had so far recovered as to assert, in bidding good night to the company, that he knew another story, quite three times as dreadful as that one, and would tell it on the first opportunity that offered. Well, let that be a lesson to anybody contemplating grave robbing, though I certainly hope nobody listening is, but you never know. I certainly enjoyed reading to all of you, and I hope you enjoyed listening. I will see you next time. This was Page Turners with Margaret Dixon.